Field here tonight. Welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. I have some very unusual things in the studio, as well as some unusual people with me. I have Lord John St. Andrew, Prior of Zachary Keep Abbey, and Mistress Morgana Naha Cerdwyn, Baroness Wintersgate. Very exotic.
Thank you, my lady.
It all means something, too.
Okay, we're going to get into that. My guests are members of the Society for Creative Anachronism, and they affectionately refer to that and have been as
the SCA.
So I guess for the next hour, when we say SCA, that's what we're talking about, the Society for Creative Anachronism. Where did that name come from?
Well, it's pretty much self-explanatory. An anachronism is something that's out of its time, as though you would take a .45 pistol back into the Middle Ages. We are bringing the Middle Ages forward, but we're doing it creatively. We leave out the Black Plague and kings beheading us and things like that, and concentrate on the things that are the more positive aspects and like, the more fun aspects.
Yeah, we keep things like chariots, which we call our cars, and eyeglasses, things of this nature.
And we feast, and we dance, and we play, and we fight.
The name was coined by a fantasy science fiction writer by the name of Marion Zimmer Bradley sometime about 20 years ago. She is one of our founding members. We have a number of noted authors that play our game with us.
Where was she when she was creating this?
Berkeley, California.
That's the heartland.
That's the home, the birthplace.
Heart of the Kingdom of the West, the oldest kingdom in the society.
How many members joined in the very early years?
The very first event didn't even start out to be an event. It was a farewell party for Diana Paxson, who was leaving the Berkeley area, and they decided to do a little tournament. In fact, we recently got to see moving pictures of that first tournament with people hitting each other with sticks and using garbage can lids for shields. We were all going, safety. Oh, no. It was a miracle no one was hurt.
How primitive.
Oh, really? Very primitive.
I was absolutely shocked to find out that what they had been using for swords was a piece of aluminum tubing that had been flattened out.
Very dangerous.
Oh, extremely so. It's a wonder they didn't really have some very serious injuries. Our swords of these days are made out of rattan, which is a like a solid bamboo. What it is, it's flexible. It's hard. It's flexible, and it's being of long fibrous material like it is, that when you hit it a lot on a sharp object, instead of breaking off like pine or oak or something, it leaves a sharp point. It mushes out and then just kind of folds over and say, "I'm not going to play no more."
Very safe.
Well, we definitely want to get into this equipment because there's some wonderful things here in the studio with us. But I want to go back to this original. Okay, they had a going away party for someone that in fact was a little tournament that included a joust.
Jousting is very specific. That's hitting each other on horses.
I know.
We don't joust because you have to train you and you have to train your horses, especially equipment. You can go to a jousting school in England.
Okay. They still have a jousting school in England?
You can take you and your horse to England and learn how to joust. But we just call it fighting because that's what it was. The old broadsword style has been recreated from tapestries and people just doing it. If you look at old movies like El Cid, you will find out once you've been in the society for a while that they are really trying to fence with broadswords. It's the wrong technique altogether.
You know, I must say that I have to admit that most of my knowledge comes from Hollywood movies like El Cid.
They're using the weapons as though they have a point, which is what epees and foils and those types of things do. A broadsword was a slashing weapon. Didn't really have a point. The slash is what counted. It's a different style altogether. But, of course, they didn't know that because no one really fights that way except for us.
That's one thing I would like to point out about the slashing. Everybody gets a bad connotation. It sounds crude. And since I have gotten into the combat of the SCA and found out there is really quite a bit of grace and style involved in use of the broadsword.
Well, the Knights of the Round Table, they had to be very skilled.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. I could give you a brief history lesson of a young lad who is about 5 years old. He becomes a page and learns the social graces and how to act amongst people. And then when he gets to be about 8 or 10, he's put over to be a squire to a knight who teaches him how to fight and how to sing and how to
take care of his armor.
Take care of armor and horses and this sort of thing. And then
a squire is a manservant, basically. An apprentice.
An apprentice, because right. Servant has a bad sound to it, but he does serve.
He does serve the master, and he helps him get in his armor.
In the Middle Ages, everybody served somebody. I am a duke. I serve the king. I would carry his bath water and take in his wine cup and wipe his little nose or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know. The ladies did the same way, and I don't care.
For each other.
The only one who didn't serve anybody was the king himself. Uh-huh. So it was not a bad connotation to be service.
But a very stratified society.
Oh, yeah. Yes, yes. It was structured rigidly so.
And everyone had their position and their duties?
I think it was everyone had their place and knew it.
Now, a lot of these things, jousts and so on, were for the benefit, were watched with an audience, right? They were set up in a formal way, like this tournament that you referred to?
Many times that was the case. The king would have a baron would have a tournament or a duke or something of this nature. There are edicts where tournaments were outlawed, but nobody paid any attention to them because they were primarily a training exercise when they first started out.
I'm thinking of Camelot, of course.
I understand. You know.
The people who were in Camelot were probably far too busy staying alive and fighting off the Saxons, the Picts, everybody else. They didn't have time for tournaments very often. They were busy really fighting. Tournaments came in a time of leisure, usually, the fancy tournaments that you're thinking of, when they didn't have someone hounding on their borders trying to come in and burn the country down.
Well, there's that incredible song that Guinevere sings where she's hoping that someone will slash themselves or whatever. I don't remember the lyrics of the song, but you remember that.
I've heard it, but I...
you don't think that's very realistic.
Within the society, what we do, we have what we call filk songs, which we take a ballad or a melody that everybody knows, and we put our own words to it.
Uh-huh.
It gets quite hilarious, but nobody understands it unless you're within the society.
I see.
Like we have a song called Freaking the Mundanes. Of course, freaking being a term that is today's vernacular.
Right.
And the mundanes being, of course, the civilian population who are not SCA personnel.
Me.
Yes. And what we do is this song is sung to the tune of Waltzing Matilda. And it goes something of freaking the mundanes, who will go a freaking the mundanes with me? As we walk down the street all dressed up in our funny clothes, who will go freaking the mundanes with me? And then it goes on about snow cones and going into a tavern and piling
that up. That arises from people leaving events in garb, of course, and going to a store, going to a bar, and getting these weird looks like, who are you?
Well, better yet, what are you?
Right. It's really odd. As styles change, certain things that if you thought about them in a removed sort of way are really outrageous become acceptable fashion norms.
Oh, yes, quite.
The spiking of the hair and all kinds of odd things. Now people are wrapping little bandanas around their legs and wearing little pink anklets with odd shoes, and plastic pants seem to be in this.
My hoopla should not be considered odd at all.
You know, and here you are sitting in this beautiful red velvet dress with the puffed sleeves and sort of wings
very, very
on it.
Very long sleeves that go to the ground. This is the form that can also be dagged with the serrated borders with the open sleeves. Uh-huh. This is just another form of it, and I find these great wings make excellent pockets.
Aha, uh-huh, yes.
Yes. One of the things
very elegant
that you could find out is if you become a little obnoxious with a lady and she happens to hit you with her pocket.
I see.
It can be devastating.
You could put rocks in the bottom of
rocks, it. Coins, keys. Well, you know how a lady's purse is. Well, she's got two of them.
One on either side. Right. The ambidextrous. Mm-hmm. All right. Before we lose this thought altogether, it started with a little tournament back in Berkeley 20 years ago.
They decided they liked it, and so they scheduled another one, and one thing arose out of another, and they started having regular events. They finally formed the society. It is a non-profit educational organization created to learn about the Middle Ages by doing it.
There was, at the time of its creation, there was a lot of Watergate and Vietnam, and the people who actually started it were your, like I say, your fantasy and your science fiction writers, people who have a romantic stream about 9 miles wide.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to get away from the
real
everyday
world,
mundane world and get back and use the, you know, the courteous, chivalric attitude. Where you can you address a lady as my lady or
you
my
could
lord.
Kiss her hand without getting slapped in the crowd. And
that's right. You know, and people. The funny part about it, within the society, you will find that after you go to an event, for 2 or 3 days later, these manners and this action and attitude carries over into your real mundane world. And, you know, it's kind of, people look at you a little strange when you talk to your boss and say, yes, my lord, what do you want me to do today? Oh, sorry. You know.
Wrong world.
Right. The wrong world. But,
well, anyway, one thing evolved out of another, and as it got larger, of course, they had to start structuring it. And now there are, you know, it's the corporation laws, and then there are the kingdom laws, and the kingdoms have, of course, kings with big tourneys to decide who's going to be the king. West Kingdom, to which we belong, the oldest and the best kingdom.
Amen.
Amen, right, has three tourneys a year and three coronations a year. So we have three kings a year. Most of the kingdoms only have two. And you start thinking in terms of kingdoms in the SCA. See, there's Ontier, that's Washington and Oregon and Montana and parts of
Idaho.
Of Canada.
Canada.
And then there's the West Kingdom, which is Northern California from Berkeley on up. And then there's Cayeed, which is Southern California down. And there's Aitkenveld, which is Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado. And that all used to be West Kingdom originally. But the other groups broke off as they got large enough to form their own kingdoms. You have to have a minimum of 200 members.
They didn't have to fight.
That's paid members to national. No, they didn't have to fight for freedom. See, one of the things that if we come up with all the officers and all the newsletters, the prerequisites, that then the king will more than happy say, yes, take it. I don't have to go so far to see you. Mm-hmm. Let you be your king. Let you have your king, and he can run around your area. See, one of the things the king does is he is bound to attend a certain amount of functions throughout his kingdom.
Well, we found the first difference, though. I bet there isn't any taxation. Otherwise, he wouldn't let you go so easily.
Well,
pay society.
I mean, we were talking about the best of the Middle Ages.
But that used to be the motivation for expanding your kingdom. I mean, there were extra duties,
we do end up expending monies, bringing people up and stuff, of course.
Yes.
Well, kings have visited all the way to Fairbanks.
But we pay their way, send them back and bring them up and put clothes on their back and food in their tummy and a place to put their head at night. And then
that's
we entertain them when they're awake.
That's as good as taxes as I know.
That's very taxing, my lady.
It depletes the pocketbook just as quickly as taxes does.
Rapidly, actually, more rapidly.
Okay, as more people became interested in this and got involved with the activities, the kingdom numbers and the kingdom sizes increased.
Yeah, there's about 10 kingdoms now.
We have about 10 kingdoms, and I believe, being now that we are an international organization.
Oh, my goodness.
There's a crown principality in Australia.
And also one in barony in Germany, mm-hmm. the barony of Drachenwald. And we have probably, there's groups in England and maybe France, I don't know. Usually it sprouts out of our good friends, the military. They drop in and say, oh, wow, let's do this. And then they carry it away with them. And
whoever's left there continues.
Uh-huh. Except for Australia now. That didn't happen in Australia.
They arose out of their own ashes, as
they said. Somebody came to an event in the United States and took it home with them and says, do you know what they're doing? Let's do it, too. And they have done a marvelous job.
Yeah.
So now you can go and travel around the world and visit other kingdoms. So they give you
most of the kingdoms are American, of course. Yeah,
they give you a friendly
reception. The SCA is a very friendly organization. Basically, if you get into an area, you can there are ways to find out who to contact, find out what's going on.
What are the ways?
Well, there are newsletters which give
mundane ways. You use the mundane ways.
Oh,
yes.
Well, our newsletters, I mean, are all of our event, you know, what's going on, where and when, and who to contact, how. Sure, I mean, that's just communication channels. They existed in all times in one form or another. Mm-hmm. We don't have, you know, you can't send your herald 1,000 miles away to say,
horse.
I'm coming, you know, type of thing.
Well, it's easier to get on a far caller and say, hello, yes, I'll be there next week.
A far caller.
A telephone.
A far caller being a telephone. Mm-hmm. I love the creative vocabulary. area.
Airplanes are wyverns, you know.
Wyverns,
yes. They were a mythological flying beastie.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
And it's not unusual an event to see one flying overhead and people call for the archers.
Yes.
You need some wings on those arrows if you're going to...
Well,
those
an arrow can go
wyverns.
Awfully high pretty quick.
Yes. Not that high necessarily,
true.
But the thought is there.
Watch out, low-flying wyverns.
Right.
Yes.
Morgana and her deadly bow.
And she is, too.
Okay, let's go over your name, Mistress Morgana. How did you happen to become the Baroness of Wintersgate?
Well... The group started out as a shire about 6 years ago now, and I was its seneschal. That's the coordinator, the administrator for the king.
Say that word again for us.
Seneschal.
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 That's a real word.
That's
from,
a real world word from medieval times, right? It was usually the person in the castle who spoke with the word of the duke, kept the keys to all the offices, and did everything that he wanted done, made sure it got done. He said, Seneschal, I want to be here then, and the seneschal would make sure it was all set up.
An administrative assistant.
Yes, literally, I administer for the
also,
king.
Also, the symbol for the seneschal is a brass key.
Gold key,
well, depending on how rich you are.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually the coat of arms is a gold key and a red field.
How big is the shire?
Well, originally, and now about five members is the minimum. At that time, we had three, which was the minimum. And the two other founding members conned me into joining and then gave me the job that was going to take all the time, although none of us knew that at the time.
Okay. Who were you? There was you.
Miles de Brooks. He had been going down to school in Portland, which is at the time the Principality of Ontier, and had been learning about the SCA there. And he came back all fired up and enthused, and he talked to his friend. These are their SCA names, Philippe Dumorth. And they decided it would be a good idea to form a group up here. And then, of course, they'd been making their chain mail in my living room for on and off all summer, and they at that point decided that it was time that I was sufficiently primed and got me to yes, that's chain mail indeed.
And it's heavy. It's very heavy.
It's very heavy.
A
shirt weighs about 40 pounds.
About 35 to 40 pounds.
Depending
on what it's made out of.
I'm picking it up, and I'm saying, you know, just to get through a morning wearing it would be sufficient to...
If you really want to lose weight quick, that is a good way, because you get this big, thick, heavy padded gambeson that goes underneath it, and then that goes over the top so it doesn't chafe your skin, and then you run around the block three times and see if you don't drop over in a dead faint.
Let alone practice your fighting.
Chainmail looks like thousands of little key rings put together, and I presume it's safe because you can't get a sword through it.
Chainmail was designed primarily to stop slashing weapons such as your broadsword.
You could get a bruise, but not a cut.
It wouldn't take your arm off, no.
An arrow, a spear point, they'd go right through it. It'd just part right through the rings.
It depends.
But you couldn't do any sneaking around in the dark with this on.
Well, no. Actually, no. Not if you're wearing anything that rattles, too, like a pair of legs. Well, it's a funny thing, we talk about armor. We got legs, we got arms.
I remember standing in line with somebody one time, I think at the bank, and saying... Oh, yes, and I have Flinks's legs in my trunk. And realizing 2 seconds after it fell out of my mouth that they wouldn't have known I was talking about armor.
Right.
Yeah, and everybody was looking at her strangely.
Flinks, they wouldn't know what Flinks was either.
Well, it's just a name, you know.
Yeah, it's a fellow's name. He's quite a delightful lad, too.
Charming member of Silvergard and Wasilla.
Anyway, that's... goodness, and anyway, if you kept this in your trunk, you could pull yourself out of snowdrifts fairly easily.
It would ruin the chainmail, however, and that chainmail is very hard to make.
Excuse me.
You don't buy chainmail.
That shirt you were handling there averages out about 80 hours of labor with two pair of pliers and a little hammer, and you weave it like you know how people get when they're knitting and purling and so forth. You do it the same way with that, only it's 14-gauge wire. And it gets aching muscles as you clip it off and
heavy
bend
duty
it.
Work.
And, yes, it's exacting.
Not easy to alter, so you need to maintain your weight once you've determined the
size. It's easy to do wearing that.
Easy to maintain your weight wearing chainmail.
Of course, now with my rotundity here, I have to. After all, I am the prior of an abbey.
Right.
And I've got to maintain my friar tuck status. Yes.
Right. Okay. Mistress Morgana.
Yeah, back okay. To the... When we got larger several years later, we became a province, which was just a larger unit, minimum of 15 members. And we didn't want, I refused to go into the barony thing at the time because it means you have to have a baron or a baroness. And I was the most likely candidate. And I went, no, because I was still seneschal and I liked it. So we went province. And then last year, I was getting tired. It had been 5 years of seneschalate, and that's a lot of hours. And I had been working two jobs for about 8 months of that last year, and I was rapidly approaching what we call burnout. Any organization will recognize that term. And I said, I'm giving up the seneschalate as of this day. I am no longer going to be seneschal. I don't care if you have a replacement.
Then we got together and said, let's make her a baroness. And, of course, she came up and screamed and kicked and fought and finally says, all right, I'll be your baroness.
So that's like being kicked upstairs.
Yeah.
Sideways, actually. Sideways. Same size group as the province. It's just a slightly different structure. I'm a figurehead. I'm, you know, I have no powers anymore like the head with the king. I could speak through the king. Anything I said went unless I was vetoed. In that sense, as a seneschal. As a baroness, it's just will of the people. And the rest of that, the mistress is a specific thing. It's a specific title. One of the joys of being a king, I would assume it was a joy as opposed to the chore, yes, is giving recognition awards to various people about his kingdom, those who have shown service and skills and stuff like that.
Beneficence.
Yeah, yes. There's specific sets of awards, the lowest level being an award of arms, which makes you like the first step in the nobility. John's name, Lord John St. Andrew, the Lord indicates that he has an award of arms. He's been recognized for his service to the society. Then there are some middle level awards for service and arts and stuff like that. And then you get into what's called the peerage.
Well, the service award there in the middle part is the Order of the Leaf of Merit. For service, and the rose leaf, Order of the Rose Leaf.
That's for
arts.
Arts and sciences skills. Then you get to the peerage level awards, and the one that most people will identify with most readily is a knighthood, mm-hmm. which means that you have a series, you are a skilled fighter. And then you have the rest of the prerequisites of chivalry, which is
chess, you know heraldry, you know court dances, you have your graces at court. You can blazon your own shield, blazon on your average coat of arms.
What is blazon?
That means tell them what it is.
Describe a coat of arms in heraldic terms. Blazon being a heraldic term, of course. You absorb this stuff whether you want to or not in the society.
You have to begin. Okay, why don't you bring that over here and we can, our audience can't, but I'm going to look at it. This is...
Technically, it's a device. Anybody can have a device. Once you have an award, it becomes a coat of arms.
Okay, a device is a shield that protects you.
No, the device is the design.
Wait a minute.
We're talking about heraldry. Forget that it's on a shield.
Okay, but for my audience's sake, I do want to tell them that it's on a shield.
Okay, it's on a shield.
It's on a shield.
One of the reasons heraldry developed was to identify people on the field. You put the device on the shield, and you could see who they were, because you couldn't tell who they were under the armor.
Okay, the device is the sign of
the symbols.
The symbols of who you are, because obviously when you've got these cans on your head, and
you got a whole bunch of people out there, and they're all milling around the field. You don't know whether you're going to be hitting your buddy or your enemy.
Okay. So we have a shield here. It's a fairly large shield made of metal.
It's kind of like a flat iron shape.
Uh-huh.
And generally in the Middle Ages, they were made out of oak and various woods.
Wood
and iron banding. Now,
this one,
shields have a tendency to get broken a lot. They get beat on with the
swords. I can see this one has seen some battle.
This one has seen some battle. Now, I had to admit, I did cheat. I have used metal, and this one is aluminum.
This one's aluminum, so it's not particularly heavy, but it's got some real... It looks very sturdy.
It's got about 12, 15 pounds.
Oh, yes. Oh, well.
But it's sturdy.
It's sturdy, and I have not only had to replace these little straps around the edge so that we don't... to keep the border on.
Okay, now, and then I'm going to... Or would you like to describe what it looks... the device is the design on the front of the shield.
Yes. The heraldic device in this case is Ver. I'm going to give it to you heraldically first.
You're going to emblazon.
And then we'll interpret it.
We are now going to have Lord John emblazon for us his device.
All right. The first term is Ver, with a griffin, Segriant, Ghouls, a chief argent. now. It's real short that way, but in real life, it is a ver is denotes a fur. And in this case,
a fur is a background pattern that is an abstract of a form of fur. That's how they came into being. Some of them
fur,
from a little squirrel. It's from a little squirrel in France. Most of your heraldic terms are in French, and they're old French. In this case, I've got blue and silver denotes ver.
And it's a geometric
interpretation
kind
of a fur, right?
Yeah. And then a griffin segrient gules, meaning a griffin, which is a heraldic mythological beast that is part lion. It's got the head and wings of a lion, or eagle, and the body and the forepaws of a lion.
It's typical eagle beak and eagle claws, and then
Lion body.
With a sort of wing.
It's got wings.
Eagle's wings. So it's blue and silver geometric design with this red...
Griffin standing on one foot, on one hind leg, with his front paws raised in an attack position.
Yes, sir.
And he is...
His claws are out.
That means that is the segrient part. Now, gules means red.
Uh-huh. It's a red griffin.
It's a red griffin. So he's standing on one foot in red. He's got it, and he's getting ready to bite something.
And there is no other...
Well, he's
there's one more part of the
blazon, which is
the top third of the shield is solid silver, which is argent in heraldic terms.
Uh-huh. Okay, so just say quickly in heraldic terms again what
a ver, a griffin segrient, gules, a chief argent.
Uh-huh. Okay, now you had this cleared with the...
The SCA has its own College of Heralds. We work... with the same rules that the College of Heralds in England and France and Germany use.
Only more restricted because we don't allow anything that's anachronistic.
That's right. We can't
Nowadays, you can register a modern device with like a steam engine on it if you want to, but we can't because we're pre-1600. They didn't exist.
I see. So you won't allow any kind of symbolism that has to do with an invention that was... invented after 1600.
Right.
So no references to anything after 1600.
We even have one of our little folk songs that I mentioned earlier about something with no oil wells, please.
No oil wells, please. Okay. So the Society has their own School of Heraldry, which takes submissions of...
You devise what you'd like for a coat of arms, and then you submit it to the local herald, and they check it locally, and then they send it up to the next level, which is usually principality, and they check it against all the principality devices, and then they send it to kingdom, and they check it with all their kingdom, and then they send it to Laurel, which checks all of the kingdoms against each other, and they also check with the mundane devices that they know of.
There are books.
There's a $75 volumes. Book called Papworth's that they check with, which
called
is
what?
One of Papworth's Armorial.
And
it's
that's
a delightful book if you're into heraldry at all.
Yeah, it's got everything in the mundane world that you can think of probably in it.
So anyone can design a symbol. It isn't something
everybody's
that you have to
encouraged to.
Yeah, you got to have the courage to do it, to learn the terminology.
But everybody's encouraged to design a coat of arms and submit it.
So it isn't something that you have to be a high level in the society in order to have a coat of arms.
No.
And sometimes it's the opposite. The mistress in my name means that I was made a peer and equivalent to knighthood, but for service, it's the Order of the Pelican. That's the little device I'm wearing around my neck here.
Okay, what?
That's a pelican feeding its young by pecking itself, and they're feeding on the blood. That's because it's service. You beat your head up against a brick wall doing things for the society. That's the service symbol.
How straightforward.
Yes, we love the symbol because usually by the time we get period, at that point we're starting to burn out.
It's very earthy.
So that's what the mistress means in my name. And I've been a pelican for 3 years, and only in the last year and a half did I finally get my device through. The first one was rejected, too close to a mundane device.
Who decided about the pelican?
I'm not sure. It's an old... The first order of chivalry, of course, was the knighthood. That was the first one they instituted. And then they instituted one for arts and crafts because some people are obviously artisans and were teaching and metalwork and
a very delightful young lady who lives in Wintersgate, which is the Fairbanks area. Her name is Mistress Dampira Snowsong, and she has a voice that is like the angels
like
sing.
A song, yeah.
I mean, she writes and she plays a number of instruments,
and she composes just her own music. It's lovely.
Oh yes, she is. She's just constant joy to us.
She's a Laurel, a member of the Order of the Laurel.
Yes, she is
for
mistress.
Excellence in the arts. So, and I have it for service in.
The king makes all these decisions?
People can make recommendations to him, but he ultimately has to say so and who gets what.
Are there no queens?
Oh, yes. Are queens, but whoever fought in the tourney and won is the one who ultimately has the right to do this type of thing.
Who is the king?
Yeah, right. We will probably have a fighting queen fairly soon. We've had fighting princesses already. And there are a number of female fighters in the SCA who are very good. And it may not happen in West Kingdom for a while because that's the hotbed of the best fighters in the known world.
Yes.
But in some of the other kingdoms, we're very likely to have a fighting queen. Then she will have the right to do all of this stuff, taking
feedback
from the king.
One of the fascinating aspects of the SCA is the fact that you can become known worldwide, especially like one gentleman who I'm primarily thought of as Duke Paul of Bellatrix. Who is the father of the SCA fighting, you might say. He has developed our style. And
Duke means he's been king at least twice.
Yeah.
He's been king about 9 times.
They're thinking, I've heard rumor of something about what they call a grand duke for somebody who's been king about 8 or 9 times.
Radnor is pushing it rapidly. Right?
Yes, another young lad who's quite delightful. The ladies fawn on him.
Duke Paul is not a young man. Duke Paul is probably in his 40s at this
point. About 42, I'd say.
And he's, you know,
prime of life.
He's actually past his prime for your average fighter.
Yes.
Fighting skills hone quickly and disappear quickly if you don't keep them up. But Bellatrix is an incredible fighter. There are blows named after him as he's been in the society.
Bellatrix
since
Snap, Rising Snap, Bellatrix Snap.
This is amazing how elaborate and how well defined this. I understand that you have the whole medieval manners and so on to call on, but I mean, this is a very detailed system that you have, a very detailed society.
It
that
took us
20 years
to become so detailed.
But that's not very long. I mean,
That's a lifetime.
Well,
there were a second generation.
Yes,
there's William of Houghton and Christopher of Houghton. Christopher's the son. They've both been kings.
William of Houghton was so pleased when his son
beat him in the finals
and a tournament and took the crown. He was really happy about that. You know, I mean, and that's, you know, it's you consider the fact that whole families get into it. And I mean, it's not just an individual that goes out and puts on funny clothes and runs around and does strange things. You got a whole family who bring up their children in a style where your gracious manners and it's fantastic, the concept.
Yeah, we start the young people out often serve at feasts just the way pages would and stuff like that.
Okay, this is an elbow
arm.
Well, we call that an arm.
An arm. Uh-huh. An arm.
It covers the forearm, the elbow, and the upper arm.
Upper arm. It has
It's an articulated plate.
It's an articulated plate.
Mm-hmm. Which means it bends.
It's made out of what kind of metal?
It's made out of about 18 gauge steel.
Okay. And there's basically
made by a master armorer.
Yes.
There's
this
basically
was made
a little cuff here on a hinge that fits around my forearm.
Uh-huh.
And then a leather strap that straps
hold
that
it
in.
Close.
Then there are several plates and a very attractive sort of pointed elbow thing with a kind of
you call that an elbow cup.
An elbow cup. And then what is this part called? It's a little
well, truth of the matter is I call it a flange. What that does is it sticks out above your arm a little bit so that if someone comes across and doesn't catch you with a sword, it doesn't catch you in the elbow. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
The bare skin where it's not covered.
And then there's another part that goes in my upper arm and has some straps around it, and there is a red ribbon hanging from it.
Yes, the red ribbon is a favor. Now,
favor.
When I go into combat in a tournament, I will have a lady's favor. She will, and that will give me strength and courage and really make me dashing. It's like a little talisman that she gave me to carry her favor into combat, and so everyone will know that I am her knight fighting for her honor.
I see. Okay. And this is an arm, but you also have legs that are similar.
Yes, I
have
legs,
this sort of
the same situation. only they're just bigger.
Okay. And since we're on this, and all of this, of course, you all have to develop, or some people, at least in the society, have to develop the skills to make these. Because
that was made by Master Armor, Sir Master Robert Kinslayer. He is a knight, has been a knight for a long time, and just recently, about 6 months ago, he finally was made a member of the Order of the Laurel for his excellence in armor making, the science thereof.
You see here along the edges, it's curled in around so that you don't have sharp edges.
It's very nicely done. Yeah.
Person said, there's two kinds of armor in the SCA. There's armor and there's Kinslayer armor.
oddly enough, because of the way it's made and the articulation around the elbow, which articulation being two or three plates that are sort of like...
They're hinged.
And
allow
so
the elbow to bend.
Arm can move.
Mm-hmm. In a normal fashion.
Sort of like plates on an armadillo or...
Oh, exactly.
Okay.
It's a good example.
I'm just trying to explain to the audience who doesn't see this. Actually, it looks like it wouldn't be all that uncomfortable. I don't about the chainmail, but I think this would be okay.
The armor that I wear, when I put it on a scale here the other day, and it came out to 68.5 pounds. That's with my breastplate, my legs, my arms, my helm, my shield. And where you say 68 pounds, you pick it up and you kind of go, oh, God, that's heavy. What you do when you got to disperse across your body, it's not all that bad.
With some practice.
Well, even a little practice on it all helps, but it's not that heavy to carry around when you're wearing it.
Okay.
When I brought it into the station this morning, we were talking. I said I should have put it on instead of just carrying it down in this bag.
It's easier to carry when it's put on. But your squire was probably missing.
My squire was off doing his Saturday morning cartoon run.
Okay, now you have. There are a couple of other pieces of equipment that I want to discuss here. You have it's very large. It's about 4 feet long. Is that correct?
Well, this is what I call my lady. Her name is Swan Song, and she is what they call a sword, a hand and a half sword. They have another affectionate term for you, but I'm afraid the radio audience wouldn't appreciate it. Something that a file is called the same thing. And she is 46 and a half inches in total overall length with 36 inches of blade. She is highly polished, double-edged. She comes to a gentle taper to her point. And she's made out of spring steel with brass quillions, which is the part that protects your hand.
That's the little
rosewood hilt and a brass pommel stone, which is the big round thing on the end here.
Let's have her sing for us.
She sings in the key of E, and I hope it comes through the radio. And she could go on like that for about 2 minutes.
Maybe they should tones with the singing swords now instead of those.
Well,
that's a lovely sound.
Someone was telling me the other day they went and saw Excalibur, and where the sword come out of the water, said my sword looked just like it.
For anyone who's seen Excalibur, then you know what it looks like. It's very beautiful.
It's very, very plain. It's not ornate.
No.
It's
very
functional.
It's very plain.
I have always, when I was a young lad, wanted a real sword.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can go down to the store and buy something you put on the wall, and if you hit anything with it, it's going to bend or break. Swan Song will not.
Swan Song will not. I think she's ready for duty. All right, and also now, the helmet. This is a black helmet that comes to a peak. It's got...
It's called a sugar loaf.
A sugar loaf. It's got brass struts, one in the back and the front and two on the side, and a lot of brad work on it, rivets.
Rivets. Well, it's made out of several small pieces of metal that's folded and shaped together and then riveted together, and then I have I have padding on the inside with a leather chin strap.
And a very serious-looking eye guard that's barred. And this really looks like an antique Darth Vader, actually.
Well, the sugar loaf, that's a real style of helmet. This is an authentically styled helmet as opposed to a functional
one. One of the things we have found that when the society was first forming and we were getting our fighting styles and gear, We tried various things, football helmets, crash helmets, and they broke.
Freon cans.
Freon cans, we started working with those, welding them together and cutting holes
they
in it so
you could
see. They
deteriorate rather quickly.
Yeah, but they break also. So we went back to the styles that the old boys way back when really used. We found out, gee, them guys really knew what worked.
They knew what they were doing.
They knew what they were doing.
Well, they were trying to protect their lives, so. Okay.
Yeah, they had something more. Well, actually, the truth of the matter, my lady, is that if we had not wear this material, our lives would be forfeit also if we fought in the style that we use.
Uh-huh.
Our swords, like I mentioned earlier, were made out of rattan. Now, they did a computer analysis with a rattan sword with a tip on an untrained fighter was traveling in excess of 80 miles an hour.
Oh, my goodness.
Now,
that
sword will put a half-inch dent in a telephone pole. What would it do to your unarmored head?
Well, I don't know. I'm going to be in the stands handing out ribbons.
One of the positions we have is called a night marshal, and his primary job is to inspect every fighter before every tournament, before he goes on the field. If his armor is in any way considered to be unsafe, he is not allowed to fight.
We're very serious about our safety.
That's right. Okay. I cannot emphasize too much. I do a lot of demonstrations in school, and we also emphasize to the young people, safety first. You may have fun, but be safe.
Don't go out in the parking lot and try what I'm showing you.
Sometimes, we were talking about sticks and garbage can lids. I can remember as a child myself getting out there with a garbage can lid.
Now you shudder.
And now I shudder that I wasn't seriously injured.
Because you know the damage it can do,
yeah.
Especially an unprotected blow or an unanticipated blow that the person isn't.
You're out there. The one I hate to fight, first of all, is somebody who don't know what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
Because I can't anticipate that.
I suppose fencers feel that same way.
Yes.
You know. Okay. So before we get to the actual fight itself, I want your last piece of equipment here. Now, this is a
this is a breastplate made out of leather and metal straps. I should say straps, metal pieces or plates. And they are riveted to the leather and then formed to fit
my body. It's like barrel straps all together, sort of.
It's a barrel-shaped piece.
Welded together, and it's covered in black leather, which in fact has a coat of arms on the device on front of it, and it happens to be a red Griffith.
A red griffin. On a shield, what we call the heater shape or the shield shape.
Okay.
This particular breastplate was made on a pattern.
Could I turn it around to see the inside here? This is, it's really got metal, which is then covered with some kind of foam, but I mean, this stuff is...
There's metal underneath there, too.
This is all metal all the way around.
Lots of sort of... Again, metal plates together so that they move. Mm-hmm. There's space between them, but it's really substantial.
It's substantial. This particular suit of armor was based on a pattern. It came out of the off the island of Gotland. Now, in 1361, it's a well-documented battle, July 27th, the Danish king, Valdemar Atterdag, was going to attack the city of Visby, which is spelled with a W, but pronounced with a V. And they got anybody that could put on anything and hold a weapon and go out and face him down, and they lost.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't bother to plunder the bodies like they normally did. They left them lay there for about 6 or 7 days, or maybe things got a little bit stinky.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just dug holes and threw them in. And then in 1905, the city of Visby was putting in a water main. And said, where are all these bones? Why are they here? This must be the... Call in the archaeologists. And they exhumed about 1,800 people, and they found all kinds of armor and good stuff if you're an archaeologist type.
Uh-huh.
And among them was a suit of armor of this pattern.
And you call that pattern?
I call it Visby.
Uh-huh.
Because that's where we discovered the pattern.
Okay. A friend of mine was telling me that you had been talking about the Battle of the Weeping Skies.
Weeping Skies.
And well, so that's local chronology. See, when we first started, one of the very first things that we did, the original three of us, was decide we were going to do a demonstration at the Tennessee Valley Fair some 6 years ago. At that point, we found the young man out at Eielson and his two Shield brothers. We went from three to six.
Uh-huh.
Wow. I mean, you know, we were going leaps and guns. Well, a bunch of people from Anchorage, the Barony of Escalia, had come up because they had heard that we were getting started, and they decided to come up and play, and we met them at the fair. Well, that night we had a revel, and the Baroness of...
What's a revel?
It's just
a party,
basically.
A little
food,
gathering.
Drink and dance and singing and whatever. And the Baroness of Escalia was one of the people who came up, and she held informal court, and the Baron was down in Anchorage. And one of the things she did was welcome us to the society as a canton of the Barony of Wintersgate. Now, this you must understand, a canton is a dependent unit within a barony. We, of course, were a fully independent shire. None of this canton business that we yelled sedition and war and stuff. And that set about a 4 and a 5 year tradition of battles between us, where they were trying to subjugate their subjects, as it were, and we were fighting for our independence, which we shouldn't have been fighting for anyhow. I mean, we were independent, right? And they would come up and they would wipe out all of our fighters. We'd have to wait for the next generation to come up. We lost royally, but we had a great deal of fun. And one of them was the Battle of Weeping Skies, called because it poured rain. It was raining so hard it was running down my eyelashes, and I couldn't see without wiping them off at one point. And but we had a great deal of fun on that particular one. We had an archery battle for the first time, and where archers armor up and shoot each other with padded arrows and stuff like that.
Okay, it's just a little hard for me to, being not a very imaginative person, it's a little hard for me to imagine. How do you start a battle? I mean...
Well, you might walk up to someone and say... you remind me of a toad. And he would say, I accept.
Yes. That's a personal
I accept.
Challenge.
There you've got a battle going.
Okay, then what happens? There are rules?
Yes. Well, let's put it this way. In the Battle of Weeping Skies, the household of Zachary Keep, now I'm figuratively speaking, kidnapped the Baroness of Escalia.
She happened to be in the area, and they took advantage of it. They, oh, there's the Baroness. Let's kidnap her.
Well, what we really had in truth was we had her little banner.
That was all we had. Carefully choreographed.
Choreographed it also,
earlier.
That everybody would know. And Mr. Stampier at the end of this also composed a neat little song, which was funny. But then we kidnapped the Baron. Therefore, they had grounds to go to war with us. Of course, we demanded certain lands and the Baroness's daughter for marriage, and a few of the we're going to go to war and come up, and they're going to rescue the Baroness. Except the Baroness rescued herself the day before they got there, and so she went home.
So we couldn't produce her. We could only produce her banner.
But so. you don't have these fights in the middle of airport. Wait.
We had this fight, as a matter of fact, in a gravel pit area off of Hot Springs.
Yeah, we're down in the University West area.
And so we had several sets of battles. One was a bridge defense, and our side was defending the bridge, and then their side was defending the bridge.
The bridge consisted of two pieces of rope laid out, and you fought between them. If you stepped off over the rope, you went into the water.
That's why we have a song about Keelson walking on the water, because
Sir Keelson didn't
want to admit that he'd stepped off the bridge. Oh. I did not step off the bridge. You did, too. If you're over there, you're walking on water. Anyhow, that was incorporated into the battle song later on.
So the whole fight had to stop to discuss whether he'd really...
No.
We discussed it afterwards, after they killed him again. And then there was people standing on top of a hill at one point, defending the hill, right? And then they switch sides, and then
everybody gets a good chance to do everything.
Slash. If they're going to get armored up, they really need to do something more than a 3-minute melee, because it's silly armoring up for a 3-minute melee. They will continue as long as they can.
Yeah.
Okay, but there are certain touches, as in fencing, certain rules that are strikes or whatever you call them.
Oh, yeah.
You're getting into counting blows and stuff.
Yes, counting blows is neat. Now, I'll tell you, this is the part that you're not supposed to hit from the knee down and the wrist out. Everything else is fair game.
And if you get hit everything on the hand else is and the armored. Knee down, you don't count the blow.
I see.
Everything's armored.
Okay.
Everything is armored.
All right. But the wrist out and the knee down are not mortal blows and do not take you out of the battle.
You don't even have to go to your knees. Now, when we're fighting, we get a hit, say, on the arm.
Okay.
If we had a real sword, this probably would have taken your arm off. You quit using it.
I see.
You drop your shield and put your shield arm.
But you could presumably fight with the other hand if your arm, if you're
hit in the leg, you go down on your knees, but
and
you
fight from there. And if you
it's
get
an honor system, you have to figure. You know,
chivalry comes into the fore here, where your word is your bond. That is something that is also stressed. There is nobody will know whether you've been hit hard enough to count it as a real blow, but other than the man who got hit.
There aren't lawyers in chivalry.
No.
Chivalry code. How do you call that code?
The code of chivalry.
The code of chivalry. You don't call a lawyer and...
You don't call a lawyer. You don't sue. No.
You don't like
Did you get hit hard enough?
Like the decision.
I know you're writhing on the ground, my lord, but are you sure that was a light blow?
Okay, so...
That's the common joke around it.
You can challenge him afterwards if you don't like it from the tournament, but you don't... There's no other way of doing it.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're out there, you're fighting certain blows. If you receive certain blows, you stop using
certain parts
limbs.
of your anatomy,
yes. You get hit in the chest, you're dead. You get hit in the head, you're dead. You're acting as though you have an open face mask on, so if you get hit in the face with anything, you're going to be taken out.
Uh-huh.
Even though you're fully helmeted, that's not you're not acting as though you're wearing a full helmet.
That's getting back to the safety factor we were talking about.
Okay,
and you're
once you're dead, you have to lie there in the rain if
it's
raining.
You lie there in the rain and
at this Battle of Weeping Skies on the defense of the hill at one point we had a young Harold Mikhail Younger von Alten who was armoring up under protest. He didn't really want to be a fighter, but we needed the fighters, right? And he got hit and he took a step backwards from the top of the hill and he fell. And he fell down into this little gully. It wasn't real far, maybe about 5 feet down, sort of folded in a V, right, with his butt right in the gully, and it was pouring rain over him.
And the water was running down the gully and building up.
We thought he was just playing dead, right? No, he was stuck. He couldn't get up. And his gambeson was getting soaked.
It was beautiful padded gambeson with all of the quilting on the inside and hand-stitched.
And it was
getting soaked, and his chainmail ended up rusting. And he was saying after the battle was all over, he said, get me out.
We thought he was just playing dead, right? Because there were special recognitions for the best deaths at tourneys and stuff.
I have won twice the Gilded Lily.
And the Baron of Ascalia is one of the best. Yes, up here. The Baron of Ascalia is one of the best dyers we've ever seen. He dies a lot. He's not the best fighter. He's a charming man, but he dies so well. At one point, he was reeling around. He has corbole armor.
Dying.
He was rolling, sort of staggering around like he'd been hit too hard on the head, right? And about the time that he went down, the Knight Marshal was leaping out of the field because
he thought
he'd been hurt, right? As he went down, we noticed that he was going backwards right on the flat of his shield so he could be carried off on his shield. And we just realized the moment he hit that it was all a show, right? And I remember Ragnar getting up there and going, "You staged that, didn't you?"
Ragnar is another Ascalian knight.
He was the Knight Marshal that had leapt out thinking, "Oh, God, he was really hurt, right?" Wrong.
Ragnar of Black Spruce, I must put his name into this. He is one of the most delightful. He and his Lady Maria.
Ragnar the Rogue.
He was, when I first met him, he was Ragnar the Rogue. And he has gotten awards. And he had his knighting ceremony. I was there. And the truth of the matter, we know it's a game. We're playing a game. But that knighting ceremony actually brought tears to my eyes.
It was
even
probably
thinking
the most
about it.
Magic night I've ever had in the SCA, in just terms of the way the small hall, the people, everybody liked Ragnar and was pleased that he was being knighted.
You could feel it in the air.
Ragnar if you ever think of the young king image, right? The charming
Arthur. Arthur,
Ragnar
the only with dark
fits
hair.
It. He looks just like it. He acts. He's just got this image that just carries everywhere. He's had martial arts training, and he moves like a cat.
To the manor born.
Exactly right. And he's doing this knighting ceremony, right? And Ragnar's there on his knees, there were lights, but it felt like candlelight.
Yeah, it felt like torches.
It felt like candlelight and torches, right? Where the light was, and there was just this magic moment, right, with this knighting ceremony going on, and something that Ragnar does that hardly any of the other kings do. Was he puts the
royal
blow
buffet.
In, the royal blow. May you take no other blows beyond this, right? And he cracked Ragnar across the face, and Ragnar forgot that it was coming, right, because he'd been coached a little bit. And he sort of rocks back on his knees.
You can see his chest. I'm going to get No, I'm not.
My liege, right? I mean, it was just this most impressive thing I've ever seen. You can get these magic moments that make it all worthwhile. It is just
amazing.
That was
the same event that where Hirsch von Hennford, when we gave away the
Baron.
You will love it.
Part of the war stuff is that we used to exchange scrolls and make gestures and stuff. We didn't care if we got beat. Nobody cared if we got beat. But playing the game was the important thing. So we decided if they were going to treat us as a canton and part of them, that what we would do when Radnor came up was give Radnor part of their lands. So we got this scroll, and which we gave to the king, the lands of Aklutna, which is where they hold a lot of tourneys, right?
Now, well, during this tournament, or this court,
right?
You've got a big long hall with people lined up on each side.
Actually,
the king up front, up in the front, and then Hirsch von Hennford, who was our herald, come up with this impressive scroll, and he, my lords and ladies, blah, 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 we deed.
Now,
the king
was sitting there with Baroness Selania and Baron Hugh on his right, and he gets through reading the scroll, and I grant you the lands of Aklutna, and everybody, the hall goes absolutely silent. There was only a few of us there.
Everybody, you could have heard a pin drop, and all of a sudden you hear.
What? Does that Aklutna? And Radnor's sort of backing up on his throne, right? And his eyes are getting real big. Because he's just a young man. He was about 21 years old, 20 at that
20,
time,
yes.
Right? First time his gig. And he looks at the Baroness and goes, what's going on, right? What's
and
going on?
Of course, in the meantime, the crowd is out there going,
war. What we didn't realize was that Aklutna was part of the baronial dower lands for the eldest daughter. And we'd just given the dower lands of the Baroness to the king, right? And finally, herald who's standing behind Radnor with this great willow staff, cracks it down on the ground, says, silence for the king! And he looks at her and he says, what? He wasn't ready to say anything at that point. What?
And then, of course, in the immortal words of many a famous king, I will take this under advice.
I won't touch this hot potato with a 10-foot pole, basically.
But
right?
We had such a beautiful excuse to go to war.
I couldn't believe the response. I mean, we didn't even expect that. You know, silence to war resounding through the hall.
It was resounding. I mean, it was really great. And
we're all going, oh, my God, they're going to take our heads off right now.
The thing about it was, which was so fun, is, especially on your radio audience, got to remember that we're giving away things that are not really ours.
Right.
we're playing a game. But sometimes, if you listen to our conversations, you will think that we're really doing this, you know. I went out and killed Flinks the other day. And somebody who doesn't know will say, gee, how neat, or call the law or whatever. But anyway, we're just playing, kids. Come out and join us.
A willing suspension of disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
And, and we do lots of other things that haven't even been mentioned. I mean, we feast. Boy, do we feast.
I was going to say, what do you eat at your feasts?
Anything that's period, which rules out things like potatoes, because they came from the New World, and corn. Chocolate was really only drunk at that time because we cut off at 1600, but we fudged that one a bit because everybody loves chocolate.
Well, actually 1650, so we might be able to get it in.
It was over, but it was only drunk, really.
So name some things that you eat at a typical feast.
A baron of beef.
A baron.
A rack of lamb.
Rack of lamb. Fowl of many forms.
Uh-huh. Usually, we had a three-remove feast up here several years ago, which we will never do again. If I have
she
any say about
now.
It.
Well, it's
we ended up feeding 80 people.
Oh,
we didn't expect that many.
A remove
is from your soup to your dessert.
Okay.
And we had like two significant meats, like a chunk of beef and a fowl in each one, with about three more side dishes of salad and vegetable varieties, starting with a soup. And then we had like
desserts
of lemons or desserts of chocolates and desserts of berries at the end of each one, right?
And, of course, you have also your breads, your cheeses, your beverages of wines or ales or whatever.
And we fed 80 people.
I was enough.
We thought we were going to have about 30 people originally. So, well, try a three-remove feast.
We ended up spending...
Would you have to kill another fatted calf in the middle of the ceremony?
Let's put it this way. We had a standing joke. One of our dishes called for leeks. And we had a standing joke that the plumbers in Fairbanks were in a world of hurt because we had bought every leak in town.
I mean, they got frosted stuff out of the back and trimmed off the frost stuff and gave it to us
leak in town. We went to every grocery store.
We spent almost $800 on food for that.
I say personally, because other than what we had out of our coffers, the $800, some of us had spent our own
money,
too.
Well, we only brought about 600 in, so the other 200 came from us.
Well, I think we made pretty close. We spent pretty close to $1,000, but we ate like kings.
Well, there
it was so great.
There have been some state dinners in town that I'm sure weren't half as good and cost a lot more.
Oh, yes.
We have more fun.
Costumery and needlework is something, of course, that you learn. You pick a period. So that's something we haven't gotten into at all, was that each individual person picks a time and a place.
For their lifespan, for their period persona.
I am 10th century Welsh, a matriarch head of my own household.
I am 14th century English and an abbot.
So. Well, this has been fascinating. Lord John, St. Andrew, Mistress Morgana. I won't go into all the rest of your names. I've really enjoyed talking with you this morning. Do you have a number in case somebody is...
I can give you our contact number. It will take but 2 seconds here to dig it out. Her name is Linda.
And her number is 452-6712.
Yes.
Okay. If you want to join the Society for Creative Anachronism, that's the number to call. Thank you, Lord John. Thank you, Mistress Morgana. It's been a joy.
It's been our pleasure.